Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll meet painter John Davis Held. We'll hear the story of Ocean City's lady entrepreneurs, and naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about humpback whales off of our Atlantic coast. John Davis Held will be the featured artist at the Ocean City Center for the Arts during the month of August. He and I met recently when he told me about being raised in Manhattan in a family that had an appreciation for fine art. John's wide-ranging academic career included studies in astrophysics and computer science. John lived in a ceremonial hut that he helped build while taking an anthropology course in African hut building and sorcery at the California Institute of the Arts. From time to time, John writes software for some side money, but art has always been his passion. He began with watercolors, but much of his work has been painted with pastels.
I took pastels. Something really hit with me. Like the moment I did a pastel, it was literally like over 20 years before I even touched watercolors again. And then oil painting is something I've been doing more and more of. And so, like, for instance, the show at the Art League of Ocean City, it's maybe half oils and half pastels. They'll see a lot of skies. They'll also see some beautiful still lifes, which are all done in oil, and some figurative pieces, too, meaning they're not portraits. They're not figure studies, but they're some interesting, you know, people that I've painted.
John has done commissioned portraits along with other projects, but he has a reputation for elegant landscapes.
Well, I'm known for my skies, and skies are very difficult to paint. You can look at a lot of paintings in museums, and the skies generally are sort of the worst part of the painting, and I found it fascinating. For myself, skies is a chance to really work with light and color and a lot of glazing effects and atmospheric effects that I just don't get tired of. I used to use photographic references quite a bit, and I actually gave it up for a number of years. I found they just slowed me down, because when I'm working on a piece, there's some sort of magic that just takes over, and this is what I'm after. Suddenly I'll find the light I'm looking for in a piece, or I'll go, oh my goodness, this is what needs working on. And at that point, the piece just sort of works. Certainly for my landscapes and my skies, I rarely use references. With still lifes, there I'll take some photographic references and I'll work, but it's still the same process. Right now I'm working on a piece that was going to be just ocean and sky. And all of a sudden, I could sort of see these gorgeous, like the mist on the water and this land coming out. And I showed it to my wife. I was like, look at this. And of course, she saw none of this. She said, well, it's a start. And it sometimes takes a while to be able to actually paint what I'm seeing and get the paint there to show what I have in mind or what I'm seeing. I don't believe in waiting for inspiration. What I believe is picking up a paintbrush, and the inspiration is going to happen. I can just count on it. There's going to be a moment where all of a sudden my brush is moving as fast as I can get it to move, and then I'm stepping back, and it's almost a dance. And, you know, I trust that process.
John says that it is surprisingly common for artists to give in to the temptation to tackle complex designs rather than just keeping it simple.
Well, I'm reminded by Mark Twain, who once wrote this long letter to a friend, and at the end he said, I'm sorry this letter's not shorter, but I didn't have the time. And I think that's really well put. It's not easy to do a really simple piece of work that's just glows and has the right stuff. Another thing which artists do is they overwork their artwork. A lot of times they keep going past that point where they've sort of lost the vividness and that excitement and magic that was there. You have to really learn where to put the detail and the perfect little brush strokes and where it can be loose and chaos. And that combination is exciting, and it it works. So, yeah, I know what is good, and I don't always hold to it, but generally speaking, I know what I'm looking for. It's incredible the beauty you get out of something really simply done and really well executed with the right light that is better than anything you can do. That drama that comes from within, that spiritual sense, is going to come out in those cases, and it takes a quietness of spirit. For me, it takes being really content. I like being happily married. You know, my wife Kirsten's really important to me, and with her in my life, I can do the kind of peaceful, beautiful work that I want to be doing. It's a very spiritual practice to work on a piece. I spend so many hours with that piece and reflecting on it, and it's, to me, proof that we all have something inside of us that's really remarkable. It's really a spiritual practice, and I've had people, a couple of wives of husbands who were very seriously ill by my work because they felt like it was so peaceful, and this was the piece that they wanted to hang on the wall in their, by their husband's bed. And they, you know, come back to me years later to thank me for this little gift. And actually, I donated a piece to the Union Memorial Hospital of work, which they have put in this room for talking to families in tough situations. It was to thank the doctors who did a marvelous job there with my dad. And you can't thank doctors and nurses enough. They have tough work. And so to me, it all works together. I just have to say that it's a real treat to be able to stand in front of, you know, a panel and work on art and show it to the world and have people love it and find spots for it in their lives. And I think most artists aren't really in it for the money, and you shouldn't be as much as the fact that you're doing something that nobody else can do. There's other tremendously great artists, but if you're really hitting your stride as an artist, nobody's doing art like your own art.
John's work can be seen at the Peninsula Gallery in Lewis, Delaware, and the Troika Gallery in Easton, Maryland. But why not check it out at the Ocean City Center for the Arts on 94th Street in Ocean City while his work is on display in August? A free opening reception will be held August 5th from 5 to 7 p.m. While you're there, go north a few blocks and check out the Green Turtles' original Ocean City location, which opened at 116th Street in 1976. They have great pub food and frosty drinks. But don't forget Ocean City's historic downtown with its famous boardwalk. Also in Ocean City, in August, on the 11th through the 13th, it's the annual Paint OC plein air event. Artists will take to the boardwalk, streets, and shores to paint the local scenery. Each artist will then select their very best piece to be included in the competition show at the Ocean City Center for the Arts. They will have an opening reception and wet paint sale Saturday, August 13th, 6 to 8 p.m., and all day Sunday, August 14th, 11 to 4 p.m. Visit delmarvaalmanac.com/arts for links to this event and others like it, and to see our interview with John Davis Held and samples of his work. And now for a short break. When we come back, we'll hear how Girl Power helped build Ocean City, Maryland. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. It's been long said that Ocean City's success as a resort can be greatly credited to women entrepreneurs. One of the first recorded was Zipporah Zippy Lewis, who surely knew how to make something out of nothing. In 1845, her husband, a sailor named Jonathan, was tragically lost at sea. Zippy walked up and down the beach, combing the ocean horizon on the chance that she might see her long-lost love return. Eventually, she turned her daily grieving into a source of income to support herself and her five children. She scoured the beaches of what is now Ocean City for the refuse of sunken ships that washed ashore. This was not necessarily treasures of gold and jewels, though she may have occasionally found them. More likely, it was brass fittings and other hardware for boats that could be reused, or household items from shipping crates. For many years, she could be seen pushing an ox cart filled with her pickings, which she took inland to sell. She earned enough money to buy two lots on the island and build a house, which she left in her will to her daughters. Her tenacity and ability to prevail became a part of the mythology of the town. The story so inspired Thelma Connor, one of the city's most successful businesswomen, that a portrait was painted of the valiant widow and hung in the Zippy Lewis Lounge of Thelma's Hotel, the Dunes Manor, which you can still see today. The prevalence of women hotel owners began during the economic boom following the Civil War. Prosperity inspired a number of emerging fads, which had a direct impact on the future of this slim stretch of land along the Atlantic Ocean. Caviar, the roe or eggs of sturgeon, became the quintessential delicacy for the nouveau riche. The waters off Delmarva's coast were thick with them, so commercial fishermen flocked to the region to meet the demand. And taking the family on vacation itself became very popular among the growing middle class. But in Ocean City, it really began with all those fishermen. And they needed places to stay. Naturally, enterprising individuals, many who were women, realized that rustic housing would only attract those who really enjoyed roughing it. Accommodations that would be suitable for wives and children would guarantee a return visit. Most people would want a good bed with clean linens and substantial meals with well-prepared food. At that time, that was definitely women's work. The town grew up on an island which had previously been used mostly for grazing livestock. On the southern end of town were the cottages of the men who worked in the fishing fleet. Northward, a number of boarding houses were built in the early 1870s, including the Rhode Island Inn and Massey's Boarding House. In 1875, a handful of locals, along with a few Baltimore businessmen, opened the Atlantic Hotel on the beach nearby. New Yorkers named Stephen and Rosetta Tabor purchased a plot of land north of them. They called their property the Ladies' Resort to the Ocean. They, in turn, deeded 50 acres of what was then called Sinnepuxent Beach to a group of 105 investors who called themselves the Atlantic Hotel Corporation. The new deed allowed for streets, subdivisions, and individual lots. Among the investors were men and women whose families still have businesses here today. The Wicomico and Pocomoke Railroad Company also bought stock in the venture. They were planning an extension of their rail line to the new community. It was completed not long after, thus connecting Baltimore and Washington to the new resort, which was now being called Ocean City. Many scoffed at the development scheme, but Ocean City's first building boom was off and running. This created a great opportunity for budding hoteliers, many of whom were women. If you think about this as a division of labor, this totally makes sense. In a given family moving to the region, many a husband was planning to make his fortune fishing. While he was doing this, not only did the wife have to fend for herself and her children, but she had to find ways to make money when the fishing was slow or affected by bad weather. Fishing was also dangerous work, leaving a number of women widows, forcing them to go into business, not unlike Zippy Lewis. Rosalie Tillman Shreve was one such widow. She lost her husband in the Civil War. She began renting out rooms in her home out of financial necessity. Rosalie was so successful that she earned enough to buy a second property, a rental cottage. In 1890, she used her profits to build the Plimhemmen Hotel. It had 48 rooms and sat on two lots. It was named for her family's plantation estate in Oxford, Maryland, on the other side of the peninsula. In most cases, the hospitality industry was a difficult life, and the whole family had to pitch in. If you know anyone who grew up in the resort as late as the 1960s, you'll hear about a culture of hard work and sacrifice. Many a local will tell you stories of their first jobs as very small children changing sheets, cooking, and all manner of other chores for the family business. It was commonplace for all the kids to give up their beds for the paying guests and camp out, sleeping on the floor, somewhere else in the house throughout the summer season. By 1926, 30 of the 32 hotels listed in a brochure advertising the resort had women as proprietors. Many of the gals who ran Ocean City's early hotels simply grew into the job. Some were women who came to the resort on vacation, and opportunity beckoned them to stay indefinitely. One such woman was Ella Phillips Dennis. She and her husband came to visit the beach in 1890 because she had been in ill health. She improved quickly and fell in love with life along the shoreline. She built the Dennis Hotel and ran it for the rest of her life. The town's reputation for being run by the women was now well known, and Ella is famously quoted in an interview with the Baltimore Sun saying, "Ocean City is 70% built by women, run by women, and the men are all henpecked." During this era, the leadership of the town was referred to as the Petticoat Regime. Margaret Campbell Buell was the daughter and wife of well-connected Washington, D.C. bureaucrats. She arrived in 1900 to build the Mount Pleasant Hotel, which she promoted among the power brokers in our nation's capital, until she retired to Florida and sold the hotel in 1919 to Susan Dickerson Mason. It was only 10 years earlier that she had left her home in Parksley, Virginia, to get a fresh start in Ocean City. Legend has it that Susan created quite a sensation arriving by boat with all her worldly goods, which included her cow. Around the turn of the century, Willie Jones came to the resort for work for just one summer and stayed, marrying George Connors, the owner of Connors Restaurant, which had been in operation since the 1880s. After he died, she ran and eventually sold it, which enabled her to own a number of other businesses, including building one of the first motels in 1965, the Santa Maria. During the mid to late 20th century, the sturgeon were long gone, but the hospitality industry continued to thrive with a number of successful women at the helm, including Thelma Connor, Anne Schall, and Eunice Sorin. This list does not include a host of other entrepreneurial ladies in real estate, retail, food service, and amusement businesses, among others. Certainly, the men of Ocean City have done just as much to promote progress in the resort. The story just seemed timely with the recent achievement of a woman heading the ticket of a major party in a presidential election for the first time. The reality is that since its beginning, women have been equal partners in the sweat equity required to build this country to what it is today. Ocean City and other towns like it are proof of that. If you'd like to learn more about this topic, visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history, or visit the Ocean City Life Saving Station Museum at the Inlet in Ocean City. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On July 29, 1939, 171 white marlin were caught in the Atlantic off Ocean City at the Jackspot. It was the largest single day's catch ever recorded, which led to Ocean City becoming tagged as the white marlin capital of the world. And on July 30, 1952, what is now the eastbound span of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge opened to traffic. It's time for a break now. When we come back, we'll hear about humpback whales from naturalist Jim Rapp. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, DelmarvaAlmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about humpback whales.
Earlier this summer, the residents of Bethany Beach in Delaware awoke one morning to find that a dead ocean giant had washed ashore. They gathered around the body, gazing in awe at the 33-foot marine mammoth that had been delivered in the dark by the previous high tide. Scientists at the scene announced that the colossal carcass belonged to a juvenile male humpback whale. The 33-foot length indicated that he was between 1 and 2 years old and weighed around 33,000 pounds. The young whale was roughly the length and weight of a small motorhome. A preliminary investigation of the partially decomposed body found a gash in the whale's neck that may have been caused by the strike of a ship's propeller. Following the harvesting of its organs to perform a necropsy, or animal autopsy, the dead whale was buried in the sand along the Delaware coastline, just a short distance from its ocean home. The story of the dead whale made the news as far away as Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. Beached dead whales often make headlines, as do sightings of these mysterious marine mammals when they venture out of the Atlantic and into our shallow Chesapeake and Delaware bays. Newsrooms know that we are fascinated by whales, dead or alive. The dead humpback was likely migrating near the Delmarva shore when the presumed blunt force trauma from the propeller ended its short life. Thousands of humpback whales migrate north along the Atlantic seaboard during the spring. During migration, humpbacks stay near the ocean surface, where they are more likely to encounter shipping traffic. Lucky whale watchers on Delmarva sometimes see them performing magnificent aerial acrobatics, such as jumping out of the water, a behavior known as breaching, or slapping the ocean surface with their immense tails, fins, and heads. Whales can also be seen when they surface to breathe through a blowhole located on top of their massive head. With each breath, they release a spout that may be 20 feet tall. Humpbacks migrate from winter calving grounds in the warm, tropical Caribbean Sea to feed in the cold, bountiful waters found at higher latitudes, such as the Gulf of Maine. They spend the majority of the summer feeding on plankton, tiny crustaceans known as krill, and small fish such as herring, mackerel, and sand eel. Humpbacks gorge themselves on up to 3,000 pounds of food each day in the summer, which is necessary for surviving the lean winter months. During the winter, they will live off of the fat reserves stored in their blubber. Humpback whales are filter feeders. Fibrous comb-like plates, known as baleen, act as filters in the whale's mouth. Baleen is made of keratin, the same protein that makes human hair and fingernails. Humpbacks can have up to 300 plates of baleen inside their mouths, which are worn down at the edge by their giant tongues to form a bristly fringe. When feeding, the whales gulp enormous mouthfuls of water filled with tiny prey animals. As the mouth fills with water, their pleated throat expands and balloons outward. When the whale brings its immense jaws together, the water is strained out through the baleen, and the plankton, krill, and fish that remain are swallowed. Humpback whales are known for their skill in hunting large, swarming shoals of small invertebrates and fish. They can blow air bubbles around their food to herd or disorient their tiny swimming prey. One social hunting technique, known as bubble netting, is unique to humpbacks. A bubble net forms when a group of humpbacks swim in circles around their prey, blowing air bubbles as they swim. As the circles get smaller, the bubbles form a net that captures the food. While some whales are busy making bubble circles, others dive deeper to push prey toward the surface. When the bubble net is set tight and the prey are corralled into dense groups, the whales will burst upward with their huge mouths open, swallowing the food-rich water in one big gulp. Named after the arching above-water hump that forms near their dorsal fin when they prepare to dive, humpback whales can grow up to 60 feet long and weigh 40 tons. Females tend to be larger than males. Even baby humpbacks are big. A newborn weighs about 1 ton at birth. Humpbacks normally live for 45 to 50 years. Their body coloration is dark gray, with patches of white on their fins and belly. The gray and white color pattern on the underside of the twin flukes of the humpback's tail is unique to each animal and can be used much like a human fingerprint to identify individuals. Humpbacks also have round, wart-like bumps on their heads and on the edges of their fins. Three different species of barnacle can be found growing on their bodies. Humpback whales have long pectoral fins, which measure up to 15 feet in length. Their long fins help the humpback slow down when swimming or go backward. Their scientific name is Megatera novi angliae, which translates to big-winged New Englander. Although they are found in all of the world's oceans, Europeans gave the humpback its Latin description after documenting them in the waters off New England, hence the unusual name. In their Caribbean wintering grounds, male humpback whales gather to engage in aggressive and sometimes very physical courtship rituals. Behaviors include lunging at each other with their heads above water, dramatic bubble displays, and violent tail thrashing. Males occasionally make physical contact when they breach and land on top of one another. These fights can cause injuries ranging from bloody scrapes to death. During the breeding season, males also sing beautiful, complex songs that can last up to 20 minutes and be heard 20 miles away. A single male may repeat the same song over and over again for hours. Within a population of humpbacks, all males sing the same version of the song, but the song changes slightly over time. Scientists understand very little about why humpback whales sing. Females usually breed once every 18 months to 2 years and are pregnant for about 11 months. The one-ton newborns are 13 to 16 feet long at birth. The whale calves nurse from their mothers in the warm, shallow water, gaining weight from the nutritious milk and laying on blubber before migrating to colder water in the summer. Mother humpbacks are affectionate with their babies and will protect them by swimming close together and touching them with their flippers. Males do not help in raising the young. From the 1600s through the mid-20th century, humans hunted humpback whales in the North Atlantic for oil, meat, and baleen. The population fell by an estimated 90% before a 1966 moratorium was put in place by the International Whaling Commission. Today, humpback whale populations are increasing in much of their range. Apart from trauma caused by ship and propeller strikes, threats to humpbacks include entanglement in commercial fishing gear, marine pollution, harassment from unethical whale-watching operations, and seismic airgun blasting associated with offshore oil and gas discovery. To learn more about seismic airgun testing proposed in the Atlantic off the Delmarva coast, please visit our website. We hope you have the good fortune to one day witness a living, breathing, and breaching humpback whale from one of our beautiful beaches. Enjoy your summertime wildlife watching wherever you go, and we'll see you outside Delmarva.
Thanks, Jim. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.